right, peasants. I'm just kidding. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Eddie. And happy birthday to the birthday people and welcome to the newcomers, announced or unannounced. I'm super nervous, but my grand sponsor always used to say all of us in this room have more in common than we have different, so I'm going to try to remember that, you know. Also, I've never spoken this long, but, you know, I've got one story to tell, so I'm going to tell it as best I can as I understand it, you know. What it used to be like is, you know, my mom actually texted me today, and she said, she was telling me and my sister, she said, Eddie, when I was carrying you and your sister, I felt like I had an angel in my stomach, and I was carrying and growing and birthing an angel, right? And she told me that for the first time, you know, when I was laying in a hospital bed years later, suffering from this disease, and it hit me hard because I felt like I really hadn't lived up to the angel that she felt like she was raising, you know. And I had a great life. I had a great childhood. There were definitely some parts that weren't so great, as we all have, you know. But I grew up, you know, with a single mother, and I saw my dad every other weekend up in Orange County, and you know, I was happy. You know what I mean? I love playing with toys. I have a story where I stole my sister's Barbie and I drew Sharpie all over it so he could be Spider-Man's wife, you know, and I threw her out the window so that Spider-Man could go down there and save her, you know what I mean? And my mom came to me and she said, you broke your sister's Barbie, like you need to pay for it, you know? And I had all of my savings up to that point. It was like $27.80. So we went to Toys R Us and I bought her a new Barbie, you know, and I didn't understand why it was that I had to get her something. I was just trying to have fun, you know. I was using the resources available to me in order to, you know, tell this story that I needed to tell, right? And it doesn't really hit me until this moment why that was so selfish. You know, like that's what I've learned, right? Like that's the core of my disease, you know. You know, what it was like too is, you know, I grew up, I was a skateboarder. I love skating. I remember when I was in third grade, I was the first one in my friend group to be skating. You know, I picked it up from the local neighbor kid. I was a big crier. You know what I mean? Like if you ever skateboarder, you know, you hit your shins a lot. Whenever I'd hit my shin, I'd end up, you know, buckled over on the ground, holding my leg and whining, you know, and all my buddies didn't like that very much. So what they decided was that Eddie, and they told this to me, they surrounded me at recess one day and they said, Eddie, next time you cry, each of us gets to hit you, right? So I agreed to it because I agreed that crying wasn't a very good thing, you know, for an 8-year-old man to be doing. So they hit me, you know, and it wasn't till years later that I realized that that probably wasn't a very good thing. Like I said, I had a good life. I had a ton of friends. The only issue was that, like, I always felt, and I know you guys can relate, I always felt like I didn't belong, you know. I always felt like there was something missing in me. I pulled this stool out tonight. My big thing growing up was that I was small, you know. I'm like the other guy. I'm five five, I think. My license says 5'6", so somewhere in the middle of that. You know, I knew that was the reason that I was different, you know. I'd be hanging out with my friends, and, you know, even as kids, like, I was the little one, and everybody started hitting growth spurts, and Mom was like, don't worry, Eddie, you're going to hit yours soon, you know. And it just, like, it never came, and my friends were gaining, like, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 inches, and mine just never really got there, you know. And so that was the reason I was different. That was the reason I was less than. And the way I coped with that is I became a chameleon, you know? And I know that you guys can relate to that too, because, like, deep down inside, all of us feel like we're a little bit less than everybody else, right? Sometimes we feel we're a little bit greater than, and I had some of that too, you know? The the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. And in third grade, I tested into this into this like type of education that I made me think that I was really smart, you know? And so that was the thing that I used to like hold myself above other people, right? Like, oh, I'm in the 99.99 percentile, you know, like I'm the real kind of smart guy, you know? And so that carried me for my whole life, you know? And I loved writing when I was little. I loved drawing. I started drawing in third grade. It's something I still do. The reason I started drawing was because this kid brought a drawing to school of this really cool character that was invisible, but you could see his eyes and a little devil smile and stuff. And I thought it was the coolest thing. So I went home and I tried to draw and I couldn't do it. So immediately, like, he was better than me, right? And so I continued pursuing drawing now for like 30 years or something like that, chasing after that one drawing, you know, just trying to be as cool as that one other person that I saw. And yeah, man, the way that I kind of ran at school was like, since I always felt like I was going to be exposed. And so what I would do is I had a core group of friends, those ones that like to punch me whenever I cried. What I would do is at lunch or recess, I would bounce around from group to group. And so I would never spend too much time with one group. I would always be, you know, come over here with like the kids that were playing sports, and I'd run around and try to run the fastest and jump the highest. And then once I failed or somebody else was better than me, I'd go over here with the smart kids and see if I could do my multiplication tables a little bit faster. Once somebody else was smarter, I'd go over to the nerds and I'd talk about video games with them, you know. And I always kind of gravitated towards like the weirdos and the misfits. So I'm glad I ended up in this room, you know, because I feel like a lot of us feel that way. But even in Alcoholics Anonymous, like there's people that fit and people that sometimes feel like they don't fit. So if you're here tonight and you feel like you don't fit, like me fucking too, man. Me too, you know, my skin didn't fit, you know, and so I was always looking for that next, you know, person, place, or thing in order to make me feel like I was okay, you know. I'm going to share part of my childhood that is not what makes me an alcoholic, but it's just part of my story. And I share this because it's something I was able to overcome thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad's from New Orleans, and so every time we would go down south, I had an older cousin who I thought was the coolest guy in the world, man. I'm trying not to cuss. Coolest guy in the world, man. He listened to Korn and Limp Bizkit, and I thought, you know, and rap music like Lil Wayne and Juvenile, and I just like wanted to be like him more than anything in the world, man. And once all the parents were good and drunk and full off of crawfish and jambalaya, he'd want to take us up to play this game, man, you know, and you guys know what kind of game I'm talking about, right? And every year from the time I was 5 to 15, he would play that game with us, me and my cousins, man. And what that ended up doing is, you know, to my mind, you know, it took till I was 15 years old for me to be able to get the courage to say, no, I don't want to do this anymore, right? I got a girlfriend. I finally fell in love. I decided that this wasn't for me, right? But all the way up until then, I thought it was a decision I was making. I didn't realize it was something that I was being coerced into through power and my desire to please, right? Like, I'm a people pleaser, right? I want every single one of you in here to love me, right? Like, I want all of you to think I'm the coolest and the smartest and the brightest and the friendliest and you can relate to me the most, right? Like, I want to do whatever I can to make you like me, and that's what I did with him, right? And he took advantage of that, man. So that was part of like what was twisting up the way that I viewed the world, right? It was twisting up the way that I thought like anybody who was cool. When I first got sober in this program, I couldn't be around men. I couldn't be around older men especially, right? Because of some stuff I'll get into a little bit later. But like, I couldn't, I was riding the bus and my bike to get to meetings when I first got sober, and I couldn't be around dudes because I just felt unsafe. I'd have a physical reaction, man, and just be all tensed up, and I just couldn't do it, you know. But yeah, so that, at 15, that's what happened, and at 15, I was crawling out of my skin enough to the point where, like, I was ready for a drink, you know, and we had a bunch of friends over playing a game called King's Cup, which is probably a game a lot of you have played. You just put a lot of alcohol in a cup, and whoever loses drinks it all, you know. And I was, a foot and a half shorter than I am now, probably 90 pounds, and 8 shots of 151 did a number on me. And it honestly, like, I hear a lot in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that, like, oh, I woke up, man, and, like, I couldn't wait to do it again, you know? And that wasn't my story, you know? Like, I was super scared. There was vomit all over my car, and I had a vague recollection of confessing my love to a girl who kind of looked like my ex-girlfriend, you know? And my buddy was passed out in the back seat, and I remember being naked and two friends holding me up while I peed on a tree, and it just scared the hell out of me, man. Like, I had never acted that way before, and I told myself I was never going to do it again, and I didn't for a while, you know. I didn't drink for another probably 2 years, you know, forever. And but what I did decide is that, you know, and drugs are a big part of my story, you know. I've got the scars to prove it, and, you know, when I was like 10 or 11 years old, this movie called Requiem for a Dream came out. I don't know if any of you, yeah. It's a really intense drug movie with Jared Leto. And it shows the life of like an addict of an alcoholic, right? Like the debaucherous lifestyle and nasty, grimy parties and stuff like that, right? And I remember she showed it to us with the intention of like scaring us straight. Right. And like, you guys are like me, so you know that I saw that and I was like, I can't wait to do all that shit, you know? and I did, you know? And so when alcohol scared me, I decided, like, let's go try the rest of that other stuff. And that's what I did, you know? So for two and a half years, I tried every, you know, substance I could get my hands on. I liked a lot. I liked Vicodin a lot, and I liked weed a lot, and I liked a lot of other stuff a lot too, you know. And I won't dwell on that, but yeah, man. And so, you know, I kept it together. I graduated. I got to college. And I, you know, right around college, I started having problems. I went to UC Santa Cruz so I could smoke weed, and that's what I did, you know. And then I started, gave that drinking thing again. They had these fancy, like, IPA beers coming out at that time, and I tried those, and I thought they were really cool because I could drink three or four or six and get really fucked up and not need a 12-pack, you know. What happened is, like, 2 years later, I dropped out, you know, or a year and a half later, I failed out, I'll say, and I decided I wanted to be a cook, you know. So I came back. There was a big coup at my house. Everybody in my house was using drugs, selling drugs. We were drinking and skateboarding every night and, you know, partying every weekend. My roommate was throwing raves but they looked down on me because I got a little bit too fucked up, you know? And so they threw a coup and called my parents to come and pick me up one day. And I came home from work and they had all my shit out on the curb, man. And I was so pissed, you know? I was pissed because, like, they betrayed me, right? They turned their back on me. And that was, like, the beginning of, like, when the really bad consequences started, you know? The consequences, you know, got bad, you know. By the next year, I went to jail for the first time on a possession case. My parents helped me out of that, you know. I'm not proud to say that, but they did, and I'm grateful for that today. I had my first seizure the next year, or within that same summer, I got arrested. I started losing friends, and stuff went downhill really fast. But for me, and again, I know you guys can relate to this, is like, it didn't really matter because all of those things were just like extraneous to what I was doing that felt right to me. From that first shot of 151, that first pill, that first hit, that first tab, that first shot, whatever, like, that was my medicine, right? That was the thing that finally made me feel okay enough with me that I could connect with you and not feel like we were on two totally different levels, right? And it was, so since it was my medicine, like, any reaction that you were having, that my loved ones were having, that they were crying and begging for me to stop, and Eddie, please, we don't like you when you're like this, you need help, all of those voices didn't matter because you just don't understand. This is the only way I feel like I'm normal like you, right? And so the consequences just continued, you know, and I got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous at 19. you know, and I came here and I came to rooms like this and heard a bunch of lame, lonely, sad people that couldn't figure it out, and they had to rely on their silly little God because they were weak-minded and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and I sat in the back, in the shadows back there with my arms crossed, judging the shit out of anybody who talked from the podium. You know what I mean? And that was my truth back then, right? Like, that was the best I could do, you know? All I could see was what was going on within me is that I felt like a piece of shit, right? I couldn't get my life together. I was a loser, right? But all I could do was judge you for it, you know? And so naturally I left, you know? And that's, I spent seven more years, multiple ER visits, and I'll get to the recovery part, you know, multiple ER visits and, you know, burning every bridge, countless friends, cars, jobs. I love when we read more about alcoholism because I did yoga, hot yoga. I tried exercising. I tried girlfriend. I tried boyfriends, you know, I tried I tried working one job, two jobs. I tried moving. I tried staying, you know, I tried everything I could try, you know, I tried massages and like nothing, things would work for a period of time and then something would happen and I would go back to drinking, right? Like I could get a month, 2 months. Just saw a buddy. I would get a couple months and then like the pain of just life and being me, and I would feel different. And that dude sitting in the back with his arms crossed, judging everybody, got really alone and really, really scared and in a lot of pain. And in that pain, it was really reasonable to take a drink, right? And so I did, you know, and then I was off to the races with other stuff. So, I had a gnarly experience where I, you know, had a crazy abscess from some non-AA approved substances. You can ask me about later. That there's a scene in the end of Requiem for a Dream where he loses his arm, and that was about to be my story. I had a 25% chance of keeping my arm and a 50% chance of survival. The infection made it about an inch away from my heart. Obviously I have my arms and I'm still here. And when I got out, I just kept going. You know what I mean? It didn't faze me. People are like, oh, that must be your rock bottom. That must have been it. But that was just like, I just got caught. You know, I just like had to go to the hospital just because like I physically couldn't do what I wanted to do anymore, you know? And so it took me 2 more years, you know? And finally what ended up happening is that the last person I had on my life, including in my version of More About Alcoholism, I'd tried therapy, I'd tried psychotherapy, I tried EMDR therapy, and a lot of it helped. You know, I tried psychiatry, I did electroshock therapy when I was at Mesa Vista one time. All of that, you know, I tried all the antidepressants, anti-anxiety, everything, you know, and it all worked until it didn't, you know, and what happened was my therapist was the last person that I had on my side, you know. And what I had told her, I'd made a deal with her. I went to a place called Whiteside Manor up in Riverside. I went to a place called Cry Help a couple years later up in North Hollywood to go to rehab. I've been to Mesa Vista 6, 7, 8 times. That other one up north, I forget what it's called. And she said, Eddie, if you've stopped going, I was going to Kaiser's outpatient program. I was going there every day religiously, one meeting a day, 2 meetings a day sometimes, Monday through Friday. I had like 3, 4, or 5 months sober, and I went from 5 meetings a week to 3 to 2 to 1, like the same story we hear, right? And you guys already know where I'm going. I was down to 1 meeting every 2 weeks, and then I was at none. And she said to me, she said, Eddie, you're going to drink. Like, you've done this, we've been doing this dance, like, for year, like, 3 or 4 years at this point. Like, you're gonna drink. This is what we do, you know? And I laughed at her. And I laughed at her because I had just gotten my second job. I had just gotten a nice $4,000 car, you know, which was the nice, big level up from my first $500 car, you know? And I was really proud of it. I had just started dating a girl from rehab, you know? And she had a dog, so I was basically a stepdad, you know? Like, I was doing really good. And so, genuinely, when she expressed concern that I was going to use and drink, I laughed at her. I laughed at her, and I went home, and I got loaded that weekend, right? And I only was out for 4 days, but I overdosed in the Albertsons downtown and got out and was ready to go back at it again. I went to go meet with her before I did that, and she said, and I came in with my tail between my legs. I said, you were right. I didn't see it coming. I thought I was doing good, and I drank again, right? And I go to her and I'm expecting, okay, I'll quit my jobs, I'll sell my car, I'm going to rehab again. I'm just wiping the slate clean, like filing bankruptcy, right? I'm just gonna wipe the slate clean and I'm gonna go get well, you know? And she said, you know what? We've already done this before, Eddie. You know, we've done this before. We've sent you to programs and you're not changing, you know? So good luck, you know, and good riddance. I don't think we need to see each other anymore, right? Like I said, this was the last bridge that I had to burn, you know, and I burned it. And so for the first time in my life, I didn't have family talking to me, didn't have friends, didn't have a job, didn't have a girl. I had nobody left in the world to manipulate. Even my dealers and my drinking buddies and my homeless buddies behind the dumpster, my friends that I like to, you know, get weird with in the bushes, like all those people were pushing me away. The dealers saying, don't call me anymore. You know, and I had nobody left, you know, and so then obviously the next logical thing is that it's time to kill myself, you know, and so that's part of my story too, you know, and somehow I realize what this is now, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, but somehow the thought popped into my head at the time I thought it was my own that you never really gave AA an honest shot, right? Never really gave it on a shot. I sat in the back and I judged, or I sat in the middle and I judged, or I sat in the front and I judged, or I got the sponsor and I listened to him and I liked that he had a Mercedes and he gave me rides and he took me out to eat. But, and like, I got a sponsor, man. We talked about the steps. I'm reading the book, you know. I read the book, you know, from cover to cover, like a novel, you know. My first sponsor told me this is not a novel, it's an instruction manual, right? And so that thought popped into my head, and I knew there was one meeting at Kaiser. So after Kaiser closed their chemical dependency program in Point Loma, after they closed, they had a group called Surviving the Weekend, and that ended, and then an AA meeting came in, and that was the only AA meeting I knew about, right? And I hadn't been in 7 years, and so I went to that meeting, and there were three guys that had been carrying the message of AA for like 2.5 years that I've been going to Kaiser, right? 2.5 years they'd been carrying the message, and not once had they been said, come to AA. Three dudes had been walking in, Ponytail Bob, Jim, and a guy I thought was the coolest in the world, Jeff J., right? And I thought he was so cool. I thought he had so many sponsees. There's no way I could ask him to sponsor me, you know? We're friends now, and I told him that a couple years later. He's like, dude, I was just waiting for you to hit me up, you know? I was waiting. You know, because they'd been watching me, and they'd been watching me struggle and intellectualize this thing and sit in the meeting and tell you how really all I needed was I just needed a regular job, and I just needed an apartment, and I just needed a sober girlfriend and to get my family back, and maybe I should pay back Home Depot for the stuff I was stealing and return my library card or return the books I had from the library. But like, I don't really, like, need to do all of that stuff, you know, and your book and your little weird cult meetings, you know. I don't need to do any of that, you know, because I'm not weak like you, right? But alcohol kicked my ass to where I was ready to kill myself and had no other option, and I came crawling in here, you know, and you guys offered me a real solution, right? And the solution you offered me, I was so scared when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so scared that I was going to become one of you, right? I was so scared that I was going to become another big book thumping AA. I go to AA is my life. I go to meetings every day. All my friends are in AA. These, you know, losers, right? That's what I thought. And I was so scared I was just going to become this cookie cutter AA robot, you know? And I don't remember, it might have been my sponsor, it might have been someone in a meeting when I was early on. He said, I'm still kind of early on, but he said, you know, I'm gonna introduce you to yourself, you know? And that really resonated with me because that's all I ever wanted, right? My whole life, people have been telling me I had great potential. They said, Eddie, you're really going to mount something. Take this art thing far. You're going to go so far. You're so good with kids. You're going to be able to help people, all this stuff. And then here I am being weird in the bushes, you know? And going in and out of detox and just amounting to nothing but disappointment, you know. And people are waiting. It talks about in the book that his family's waiting for him to pull himself up by his bootstraps and get his life together, right? And that fated day will never come, you know. And it did, so the fated day didn't look like the fated day, really, but I came in and I knew, all right, dude. Like, let's be real. I'm going to kill myself, or then I have this other thought that had popped in that we're going to give AA a shot. And so let's give AA a year. You know, I heard over those first couple months, like, give us a year, and if you don't like what you found, do what we do, and we'll refund your misery, if you're not a satisfied customer, you know. And I haven't had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous since then, you know what I mean? And so I came in and I do what we do. You know, they told me to get commitments. I got a sponsor. He asked me two questions. He said, Eddie, are you an alcoholic? And I'm like, yeah, you know. And he said, are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? Yeah, of course, whatever you want, man. You know, I'm a little squirrely. And those of you who know me, when I'm not nervous and talking from a podium, I can be really chatty. And he said, take some time with that, you know. Here's my number. Here's the book. Call me tomorrow with your answer, you know. And so I spent the next 24 hours, and I called him at, 7 or 8 the next day, and I said, hey, Jim, I am willing to go to any lengths. He said, good, you know. I wanted you to take that time because I'm going to hold you to that, you know. There's going to be a time while you're going through this program that you're going to want to say no. You're going to think this is stupid. You're going to think this is a bad idea. You're going to think you have better ideas. You're going to think whatever your way is the right way, and whatever we're suggesting is not, you know. And at that point, I was so desperate, I couldn't even imagine having my own ideas, you know. And so I told him yes, and he did hold me to that. And so we started going through the book, man. And what he said is, we're gonna read this book. When it tells us to write, we're gonna write. When it says pray, we're gonna pray. And like I said earlier, we're gonna treat this like an instruction manual, right? And we're gonna do this like a workbook, you know. And so he told me to read the doctor's opinion, and he brought up this idea of an allergy, right? I came back to him the next day. He said, underline the parts you relate to, the parts you don't relate to, and the parts you straight up disagree with, the parts you have questions about, right? And that's what I did, man. And I had a lot of questions, and I was. You know, as best I could at that time, you know, being honest, open-minded, and willing, you know. And he told me that was the only thing that was required, you know. And so whenever I'm going to do, I love doing H&I. I just started it for the first time, got to start going back to Mesa Vista. I went five times in the last 6 weeks or something. I went to VOA with Matt for my first couple years. I've been doing SARP for the last 4 or 5 years. Something I love to say is, if you're sitting in here and, you think I want to hear, you know, oh, I'm really going to give this recovery thing a chance. I'm going to do my IOP, and, I've got a sponsor already, you know. And I'm like, oh, what step are you on? They're like, you know, and they don't really know. But be honest with me, right? If you have doubts about whether you're an alcoholic, let's talk about that. You know, if you think this program is a cult and we're all crazy and brainwashed, let's talk about that. You know, I heard somebody at a meeting this morning say, we've been there. You know, we've shared your honest doubt and prejudice, right? I've sat in the back and judged, you know, and I still can do that today, you know. I don't have a perfect faith yet, right? So we started going through the book, and we started on step one, and I knew, you know, and I hear this a lot. A lot of us come in and alcohol kicked our ass enough that we knew we were powerless, right? But what I didn't believe is that my life was unmanageable, because I thought that somehow, someday, I was just going to be able to figure it out. I just needed to get, you know, a couple of water. I knew a guy in college, he would drink a water with every beer. Maybe if I did that, I got some Chaser 2s in the morning, I started eating healthy and exercising, I'd be able to figure, I just haven't got there yet. When I was 2 years sober, I heard a guy say this, and it's resonated with me ever since then. He said, you know, maybe I could have figured it out. Maybe there is a way. Like, we've heard plenty about functioning alcoholism, right? Functioning alcoholism. The fact of the matter is that I didn't figure it out, you know? So if you're here, I hope you haven't figured it out, you know, or you're at that point where you're ready to give up, you know, because that's what worked for me. And so he said, Eddie, do you think somebody who's got a manageable life is like going to detox every like 2 or 3 months? You know, do you think somebody who's going, who's having to go to a chemical dependency program and like has a part-time job is like the best he can do is like managing his life well? You know, do you think somebody who's living with his mom and has a car that's halfway broken down is managing his life well? Not that those things are necessarily an indicator of management, because they're not. Right? Like, we can, I've seen people who have some or none or all of those things, and they're managing their life a hell of a lot better than I am, you know, spiritually. But like, that helped me realize that I wouldn't, you know. And when I was at one of those earlier times in sobriety, there was this, I went to a speaker meeting when I was in rehab up north, and there's this lady shared from the podium. She said, step one of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life's become unmanageable. It's a lot of words, it's complicated. The short version is that you're fucked, right? If you're here, you're alcoholic, you're fucked, right? Two is that I believe that this stuff's gonna work for me, that you guys maybe aren't all crazy, or at least like you might be crazy, but you've got something that's working for you. Step three is I'm gonna decide that I'm gonna do the rest of the steps, you know? And that worked for me, you know? I didn't have a higher power. I was doing step three with my sponsor, and I like, he gave me an assignment to like make up a job description for your higher power, right? Which I think everybody doesn't do that, but that's what we did. And I got to his house and I was ready to share it with him, and he said, stop, don't care. Can you do business with that higher power? And I said, I think I can, you know? And so we got, the next time we met, he said, you know, read through the third step, and we did what my buddy calls the California third step prayer. We got outside in front of a Starbucks, in front of all these people, you know. All these people are going to see me doing that? That's so embarrassing. He said, nobody fucking cares, dude. Nobody's watching you, you know, and nobody watched us, you know, and nobody shouted me down when I stood back up, you know. And for the first time, I, like, was starting to, like, take action in this program and, like, trust another man, you know. One quick thing before I move on to my, you know, to the rest of the steps is that I was really scared that I wasn't going to be able to be honest in this program when I was maybe like 2 months sober. I had never been truly honest. I read in the book at that point that, you know, the only requirements were those three things, right? Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I knew I had to be fearless and thorough in my inventory on the next step, and I was really, really scared that I wasn't going to be able to. I've been lying to myself for so long, and I had been sober long enough that I had started noticing that I would say things, and then I'd get home and realize they weren't true, right? And there were so many of those things, and they were all twisted up with all those weird experiences from my childhood and lessons that I'd randomly picked up from TV shows and movies and songs and random conversations of adults that I put a bunch of, you know, agreements that I made with myself about the way the world works. And I was just terrified, and I broke down. I used to have an existential crisis every single meeting at my home group, my old home group's Midway Bridge. Fridays at 6:30, I think it's still there, kind of died during COVID, but I used to have an existential crisis, and I broke down to my sponsor, and I was like, I'm so scared, I'm not going to be able to be honest, because I'd never been that, you know, and I was crying, and he was consoling me, and telling me it was okay, and he didn't really give me an answer, right? He just kind of, you know, he said some stuff that I don't remember through the tears, you know. And I realized in retrospect that in having that fear that I wasn't going to be able to be honest, I was able to be fearless and thoroughly honest to the best of my ability at the time, you know. And I thought that honesty just meant that all I've got to do is I just got to tell you what happened, right? That it was a very like clear, defined thing. If I just tell you what happened back then I've been honest and that's it. You know, I didn't realize I was going to have to tell you I've got 8 years sober and I'm struggling with addiction to my phone, you know, or I'm struggling with addiction to relationships, or I'm struggling in my sex life, or I'm struggling at work, you know, or I feel like I'm not enough. I didn't realize I was going to have to be honest, like right here, right now, about how I feel in front of all of you, you know. But that's what I've learned, you know, that I can be honest in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every single time I've told my truth to the best of my ability, you guys have done nothing but surrounded me. You know what I mean? You have surrounded me and you have held me. And somebody shared earlier during one of the birthdays that you guys have like held me up, you know. You know, I'll get to the obligatory end of the fifth step, you know. I wrote down my resentments. I thought the only person I was going to be resentful at was myself, because I blamed myself. Like I said, that kid who'd been abused all those years, it was my fault because I didn't say no, because I didn't get up and leave, right? And I called myself a monster for the way that I used and took advantage of other people, and the way, because I had had that twisted relationship, you know. And so I had a couple things, I wrote my cousin, you know, and my mom, my dad, ended up having 97 resentments, you know, as somebody who wasn't really mad at anyone. I'm just not an angry person, you know, because I had been turning all my anger inward, you know, you guys know what that's like. And we only had to get through, you know, like, you guys know this, like, we only had to get through, like, I don't know, maybe 12, 15, 20 of them till I realized that I was just behaving the same way over and over again. You know, chances are is like I said in the beginning, man, like I feel like I'm not enough. I'm scared you're not going to love me or you're going to stop loving me. And I'm willing to do whatever I can, including behaving in ways that aren't right for Eddie. They might be right for you, but they're not right for Eddie. And ways that I'm not proud of, you know. That's what I learned in my fifth step, you know, and I told my sponsor those deep, dark secrets that I couldn't even write down that I was going to take to the grave, you know. When I was, I don't remember how many months I had when I finished it, maybe four or five. And when I first came to AA, I thought that I would drop acid every once in a while, you know, because I you can't get addicted to it, you know, like you can't do it multiple days in a row. And I'd like go to a festival every now and then and like have a good time. And like I just kind of kept that on the back burner, you know. And at some point after finishing my fifth step, I swear to God, I hate when people say this because it sounds so dumb and fake and like an embellishment. But I really walked, you know, 6 inches off the ground to my meeting after getting all of that stuff off during my fifth step. And something that got lifted during that time was that reservation, you know. At some point when I was 6, 7, 8, 9 months sober, I realized that it was just gone. I didn't need to do that anymore, because that like thing that was inside of me, that hole in my gut, that thing that made me feel different and separate and uncomfortable and separate from you guys, like it was filled. And I was like, when people say, like, I joined the human race, I was a member of the human race. You know, at least I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I knew that you guys were my people, you know. And, yeah, man, did my hour with 6 and 7 and thought it was dumb that it was only a couple paragraphs, read some other literature that's not AA approved that we all, you know, read behind the scenes. And today, the way 6 and 7 looks in my life is I get up every morning. I ask God to direct my thinking, you know, especially that it be divorced from self-pity, self-will, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. I do the long version of the Serenity Prayer. I do the third step prayer, and then I do the seventh step prayer. And when I'm doing the seventh step prayer, I realize that, you know, I'm asking that I not act in, you know, act in from that place of fear, that place of selfishness, that place of self-centeredness. I not act with inconsiderate motives. I act the opposite of the way that I've been acting my whole life. Because see, one of those things that my sponsor told me when I finished that fifth step, he told me, Eddie, he said, Eddie, you never have to behave that way again. You know, and I didn't, because if you don't behave that way, you don't have to feel that way again, right? And that's been the truth so far, you know. Now, have I behaved that way again? Fuck yeah, dude. Like, I love acting out of my defects, you know. I wake up in selfishness and fear most mornings, you know what I mean? And so I hit my knees as soon as I can, you know. Some of the lessons I learned, I moved on to my 8th and 9th step, and some of the lessons I learned. And now I'm saying all this because it was the most powerful the first time I did it. I've worked the steps a couple times since then. And the belief that I truly have today is that I work the steps every single day of my life. You know, a good day is when I'm like living in these steps, you know. I need to remember, because I get up in the morning and I think I have power, and I think my life is manageable now that I've got a couple years sober. Right? Like, I had this amazing spiritual experience. I got to talk to all these people last night, so I'm going to wake up tomorrow and think that I'm cured, you know? And I have to realize anew every morning that I can't change shit. You know, I have power over only my second thought, first action, my attitude. That's what my sponsor taught me, you know, and that's been true for me so far. I was terrified when I was going to make amends, you know, and I still am terrified today. When I have to go make things right for the harm I've done sober, you know? And the biggest lesson that I've learned from that, I was so scared that everyone was gonna say, you know, F you, take a hike, right? I never wanna see you again, because I'd been all my twisted and misperceptions and sickness and selfishness and self-centeredness of my alcoholism, pour a bunch of booze and drugs on top and a bunch of like psychedelia and you know, violent rap music and stuff like that. And really loud metal. And like all of a sudden, like I have these really contorted views of the world, and the views I had of the world was that everybody hates me, right? Just from the jump, everybody hates me, you know, I'm not enough, right? And they, you know, if I've had any kind of negative interaction with you at all, whether you've told me or not, if this dude like looked at me with like an eyebrow, like that was it, you know? Like, he's gonna catch me in the parking lot out back, he thinks I'm lame, I'm not speaking right, I'm sweating too much, I'm not sweating enough, you know? I've got 1,000 things, right? And what I found when I went to go, you know, I don't know if humble myself is the right word, but when I was able to like be quiet enough to go make those amends, is that every single person just wanted the best for me, man. Every single person, the whole time I thought they hated me and wanted nothing to do with me, all they wanted was for me to be okay. Even the people who like still didn't want to talk to me anymore, like that relationship was moved on, they were like, all they wanted was for me to be okay, you know. They didn't want to see me suffer, they didn't want to see me in pain, you know. And for the first time in my life, I got introduced to the other side of this spectrum. You know, I had already got this negative side, this I'm not enough, this world is dangerous, and I always need to be on my guard, and they're going to get me, you know, and they're going to take advantage of me. I had that side figured out, but doing my amends opened me up to the other side of this spectrum that said, you know, the world loves you, you're safe, we're here with you, right? We're the same, and we all just we're doing the best we can, and we want the best for you, right? And it was a magical experience, man. And, you know, I launched into sponsorship after that. You know, 10, 11, and 12 is a daily struggle for me. You know, I'm getting kind of close to my time, so I'll kind of get current with you guys. You know, for the first four or five years of my sobriety, like I did 90 and 90 every 90 days, you know, sometimes more. It worked so well the first time, I just kept doing it. During COVID, I got burnt out on Zoom meetings like a lot of us did. It wasn't giving me what I needed, you know. I found boy meets girl on AA campus, right? Like, I found a girl I fell in love with that was amazing. We both had programs, sponsors, sponsees, all of that, you know. And after 2 years, it didn't work out so well, you know. We weren't looking at the same future, and we went our separate ways, right? And, always have love for that woman, yada, yada, yada. Sometime during that time, that was about 3 years ago, I started kind of going downhill, you know, and I didn't really equate it to that, but that's what was going on at the time. I didn't know how to make things right with her. I kept writing inventory. I kept sharing it with my sponsors. I kept calling my mentors. I kept trying to figure out, like, what is it that I need to do? What do I need to change in order to, like, mend this relationship? And I just couldn't figure it out, man. And, you know, over that time, I started drifting like we do, right? Like, I've heard it over and over again, between years 5 and 10 are the most dangerous times in Alcoholics Anonymous for someone in recovery, right? Is like, we get the good things, right? I've had the same job for the last 9 years, you know. I've had a couple successful, or I guess technically unsuccessful, relationships. I've got a host of friends. I'm, like, you know, current and present and known, and a part in the middle of the herd at a lot of different meetings, you know. And I was feeling like alone and empty, you know. And scared again, and my life felt like it didn't have any meaning, you know. And so what did I do is, like, I just started distracting myself, just like I did, you know. Like, my first, when I was maybe like 7 or 8, we had a cat that was going to get put down. And I like to share this story because it's my first memory of me just not reacting well to life. And we lived in a two-story house at the time, and the entrance was on the second story, and I knew the doctor was coming over to put the cat down, right? And I didn't really care that much about the cat, you know, but I knew, I could feel the heaviness in the room. Like, we're sensitive people as alcoholics, right? Like, I can feel that tension, you know? And I heard the first couple steps coming up the steps. I knew it was the doctor. I went straight down to my room, plugged in my PlayStation, turned on Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2, and turned the volume up all the way, and played nonstop for the next few hours. While that happened, I'd hear a little bang bump and maybe a tear or a yelp upstairs, and I just turned the volume up louder and escape into my game, right? Before that, I got into The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. I escaped into fantasy novels, right? I'd escape into books, I'd escape into games. And so then, you know, 5 years sober, not sure how to process and grow through a relation, you know, the loss of a relationship, like, I started escaping into my phone, you know. And so I stand here before you today. I went to a terrible retreat last weekend with Mount Soledad Men's. I've been going to that retreat. I've been a part of it. I've led it. I've done every commitment there many times over the last few years. And it was the worst one that I've been to. You know why? Because I was in my head. I was thinking about me. I was full of fear. And all I wanted to do was escape. And I'd been using my phone as a way to run away. You know, I'll just distract myself for a little bit. And so I gave it up for the retreat, right? So I'm 7 days sober off my phone today, which sounds dumb and inane and silly, right? Like, it sounds silly, but I guarantee there's a bunch of you in here been thinking the same thing. Dude, like, the same voice came up the second I put that thing away. I woke up the next morning, it was like, just 20 minutes of YouTube, would it hurt? I could scroll Hinge a little bit tonight, you know? And, like, just, it's that same voice, you know? It's that same thing. And what I've noticed over the last week is, like, I haven't been feeling my feelings again, you know? I've been sober. I've been going to meetings. I've been seeing my sponsor. I've been working with a guy, you know? I've been going to work. I've been doing all my commitments, and I haven't been feeling my feelings in my time alone, you know? So that's my next indicated step, you know, has been to give that up. And it's been really weird, and it sounds silly and dumb, but I found that a lot of people relate to it, you know? I just don't want to feel the way I feel. But the amazing thing that happened as a result of doing that, I did great at the retreat, didn't have a problem after that first time. When I got back home, they call it a spiritual hangover, right? You get this high at the retreat. It's all AA and love and vulnerability and safety and connection. And you come back down the mountain, and it's none of those things, right? The retreat's over. You know, the phone calls, oh, so good to see you. Like, hey, how's that thing going? All of that's over, and I'm alone by myself. And there's that phone, right? And what happened was the most amazing thing. It's the same thing that happened to me with alcohol, you know, is I was able to pray, right? I prayed to that stupid God that all you cult losers, you know, had to believe in. And I was gifted with this amazing peace and lightness and freedom, right? that happy joyousness, that freedom that comes from working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So I'm going to keep coming back. I love you guys. Thanks.
Oh, I'd like to thank Eddie for working on his cussing tonight and being a great speaker. Come back and visit us soon, please. I would also like to thank the residents of the House and the Women's Auxiliary for serving us a fantastic dinner tonight, those of us who enjoyed it. And Eddie, if you'll circle us up and close in the prayer of your choice, please. Thank you.